Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Tippy Talk. My name is Tippy Feldenstein, and I am dedicated to explore a life that is lived with clarity, with confidence, with control, and with awareness. And that is why we bring you guests from all around the world that have a story that you're not going to hear about on the media, on the TV, or on your TV screen movies. And today we have John F. Saltenberg, a meteorologist with the U.S. Department of Interfish and Wildlife Services, Northwest Interagency Coordination Center, Portland, Oregon. And I know that that's a mouthful, but really what that tells us is that he does so much more than we actually realize, because as a meteorologist, he actually fights fire, which you would never connect it. What does the weather have to do with fire? Well, you're just about to find out. So, John, let me tell you a little bit about him. He joined the National Weather Service in California a long time ago, in 1995. And he worked for several National Weather Service offices in California and in Oregon through 2005. And then he joined the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a fire weather meteorologist, and we're going to find out exactly what that means. John experienced providing weather support for wildland fire management in the United States and in Australia. And as an NWS, which means weather meteorologist employee, John spent 17 seasons as an incident meteorologist, working in the field on deployment with firefighting teams all over the United States. John presented weather topics at fire behavior, fire weather, and fire danger classes and workshops. He knows so much about it that I don't think I can talk to him for 10 hours and still get all that information. He also published research on weather and extreme fire behavior in the National Weather Association Digest in 1991. John is a member of the Pacific Northwest Fire Environment Advisory Council, the S590 Steering Committee, which most people don't even know exists, and also teaches weather topics at the Kalakurama Community College. He received his bachelor's degree in meteorology, so he goes way back and knows more about that topic than most people even know that it exists. And I'm really grateful for you, John. Welcome to Tippy Talk, and thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Tippy.
Well, you know, it's a wonderful day for you to be here because it is sunny, it is beautiful, and the day started out really rainy and really heavy. And so we actually experienced both sides of the spectrum today. And I know that rain and sun and all that has to do with the fire and has to do with fighting it. Can you tell us what you do? Because I don't think too many people even know that people like you exist, that the weather is even related to the fire fighting element of fire.
Yes, my job here at the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center is to keep the firefighters advised of changes in weather patterns across Oregon and Washington, and with two purposes. The first is to maintain as much as possible safe firefighting at wildland firefighters who are deployed on forest fires in and around Oregon and Washington are aware of potential changes in the weather that could affect the change in the fire and affect their safety. Secondly, my position here is also aimed toward the most efficient use of firefighting resources around Oregon and Washington and elsewhere in the United States. What we're trying to do, of course, is use firefighting resources such as firefighting crews, fire engines, fire helicopters, fire aircraft, and all the support apparatus in the most efficient manner possible to address the most costly and dangerous fires wherever they happen to be occurring in Oregon, Washington. That has a lot to do with weather patterns, and my job as a meteorologist is to forecast those kinds of things.
So you actually know when a fire is about to erupt? When you say forecast, what do you mean by that?
Well, I look at daily fluctuations in weather patterns, such as you mentioned earlier, clear skies turning to cloudy or cloudy skies turning to clear. Those can have an effect on an ongoing fire or initiation of new wildland fires. So my job is to look at different rating areas across Oregon and Washington and gauge what is the likelihood of getting new forest fires. And if so, what's the likelihood of those new forest fires becoming large, costly, and dangerous, and if there will be a threat to communities or forest resource values? On a daily basis, we look at what the pattern is, fire danger and fire weather across Oregon and Washington, and then try to anticipate what it will be over the next week or so that we have the best idea of what may be coming our way, which will affect our use of firefighting resources.
So are you saying that when you look at a condition of what the weather would look like or what it is, you can literally predict that on February 20th, the chances of a fire erupting in a certain area are like 50% or 70%? Is that what you mean by looking at the conditions?
That's right, Tepi. We have a model that we use that looks at the current conditions in weather, the current conditions in fire danger, and what is the likelihood of having ignition sources, such as lightning or such as human accidents. And so when we add up the contribution from the weather pattern, the fire danger, and the ignition sources, what we come up with is a probabilistic forecast, a probability of getting a fire or a large costly fire, exactly as you described.
Really? I'm brilliant. I'm so happy that I got it because this is so new to me. I've never heard of anything like that. And so once you predict that a certain fire might erupt in a certain area and that it might get really too close for comfort or too big, what do you do?
Well, then we pass that information in daily briefings to the decision-making staff here at the center that I work at. This center has representatives from the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And depending upon where that fire is anticipated to be, We can take action to move firefighting resources, mainly fire crews and fire engines or smoke jumpers, to the area where that fire is anticipated to begin and hopefully catch that fire while it's still small before it becomes large and costly.
So you mean you actually go to that area and wait for the fire to show up, and then you manage it when it's a baby rather than when it's a full-grown fire?
That's exactly right. There are a number of firefighting bases throughout Oregon and Washington where we can move aircraft, we can move fire engines, we can move smoke jumpers and put them in the vicinity of where the fire is anticipated ahead of time rather than reacting to it after the fact.
Wow, that's fascinating. So can you give me an example of one fire that you actually worked and how it worked out and what was the result, like the process that you went through, like an actual life experience?
Well, certainly. One that immediately jumps to mind is in Australia that happened in February of 2009. The anticipation was that there was going to be a high danger of large and costly fires across the Australian state of Victoria in the early part of February of 2009. It was February 5th. Anticipation was high. The weather pattern was primed. It was very hot, very dry, very windy. And in the event when it actually occurred, there was several hundred fires reported. And several of them became very large and costly, so much so that thousands of homes were burned up in the vicinity of the forest lands in Victoria, and 170 people lost their lives in the fire conflagration that came about as a result. That was one I participated in that fire event a number of years ago. There's similar events in the United States as well.
So the fire actually erupted. You knew this was going to erupt before it did, right?
We had a very good idea. There's no guarantees in this business, but
right.
The probability of a fire becomes large once we see all the contributing conditions are becoming maximized. Very hot, dry, windy conditions against the background of drought makes it much easier to forecast those conditions. It's more like ironing out the details and the ignition sources.
Okay, so the probability is high, and you definitely take action. You pass the information down, and everybody is there. And still, the fire erupted, and you lost control of it, and people lost their lives. Even with all that knowledge, that's what you're saying, right?
That's correct. In this case, the one I referenced in Australia, the resulting fires were so extreme in size and intensity and the rapidity of growth that even veteran firefighters were caught off guard by the combination of all the extreme conditions that occurred. And the fire, the plans for evacuation or the plans for movement of firefighting resources proved to be inadequate in the face of how horrific the actual conditions became on that day.
Right, so that's like an example of the prediction going out of control, because obviously you can't control the elements, you can't control everything. You can control what you know, and you can go by educated guesses and educated decisions making, but you can't control all the elements of all the little things that happen along the way. That's what I understand. And
that's exactly right.
Yeah, exactly. And so my producer and we're soon becoming my co-host, Robert, he's joining us also. And I was wondering, Robert, if you have any questions that you would like to ask John before I go on to the next. Okay. Robert is on mute. Robert, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we could always hear you. So if you have a question for John, this is a great time to ask him.
Sure. When I had met with John over the summer, we were talking about some of his adventures. And one of the things I thought was very fascinating was his claim to fame. He wasn't known to any of his coworkers or to his immediate boss. And he forecasted a fire. John, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how that was? It was kind of like make you or sink you. How was the pressure?
Yeah, that's a good question, Robert. The case in Australia was mainly taken care of by the Australian forecasters. I was there to help. In my own case, in the United States back in the early 90s, I was assigned to a fire incident in northeast Washington that came about as a result of a strong, dry windstorm. My participation in the firefighting effort, I had to let them know that there was going to be another strong, dry windstorm when we already had lots of fire on the ground as a result of the first windstorm. And sometimes in cases like that, you've got to make very plain to the decision makers, in this case fire chiefs and fire resource advisors, that another windstorm is coming our way and the likelihood of flare-ups of ongoing fires or initiation of new fires was high. And there was a lot of threat to community in northeast Washington. The town and the suburbs of Spokane, some of the outlying areas, roadways, resource value, power lines, forested areas, all at risk from increasing winds. And that was one of those cases when I saw the pattern shape up, I took action. I made my forecast and advisories, and sure enough, it came to pass. The fact that firefighters were able to take proactive action ahead of the event rather than reacted to it after the fact reduced a loss.
Right. Loss of life, loss of damage, loss of everything. Wow, that's something that you can never forget, that you actually were able to participate in it before it happened. That's amazing. It's like prophecy. So Robert just said that
there was also another.
Yes, Robert.
There was another story you had mentioned, John, about, you know, you have like three options, is to, you know, burn off more of the fire to control it, or to retreat, or to actually, these firefighters, what they're exposed to is some of them, you were saying, will stay there and dig themselves in and let the fire come over them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it depends upon the circumstances that are at hand. What we do with training wildland firefighters is, of course, first and foremost to take care of their safety. You know, no one's life or health is worth you know, the cost of a burning tree or a burning bush, so to speak. So they're taught to keep their own safety in mind first and foremost. Nevertheless, there are some times when fire behavior becomes so severe and so rapid and so intense that firefighters can be cut off from being able to go to their safety routes or escape, what we call safety zones or escape routes. Before a firefighter hits the fire lines, they are required to identify a safe place that they can escape to should the fire flare up unexpectedly. There have unfortunately been times when those flare-ups and fires became so severe that firefighters were cut off from their escape routes and safety zones. And in which case,
wow,
the option of last choice is for, in the United States, firefighters carry with them an aluminum shelter. It's essentially like a small tent that they carry on their belt that they can deploy and crawl into that aluminum tent while the fire burns over them or near them. And it can save their life when it otherwise might have cost them their life when the fire flares up. They've been largely successful, although there have been a few spectacular failures as well, tragic failures, I might add. So we first and foremost try to keep firefighters away from the fire and flare-ups, but in the last resort, they do have that fire shelter available to them.
Wow, that's good, but like you said, at times it could be a disaster also, because basically if they're actually doing that, it means that the fire is out of control. It means that they're at the middle, right in the midst of it, and they really cannot escape. So it's not something
exactly
they prefer to do. Yeah, it's not something that
exactly
they want to do, but it's really a last resort emergency situation, which may or may not work. So, yeah.
That's correct.
What are the temperatures?
Over 1,000 degrees outside the shelters.
When the fire is going.
That's right. So the shelters have reduced that heat, I think, by about 90% or so. So it still gets very hot and very uncomfortable inside that shelter. And smoky, and it's turbulent, and it's dangerous, and it's terrifying from what I've told from reading after-action reports. But it's better than being burned up.
Well, yeah, anything is better than being burned up. So, yeah, it's not funny. I'm just laughing because it's so scary that you know you don't know what else to do. But so what do you do today, what do you do these days, John? You're in Oregon right now, and then Robert mentioned that you were in Hawaii, which sounds like fun. Were you there working, or were you there just taking a break?
I was there taking a break is when I met Robert in the ocean off the shores of Kona on the Big Island. And we're both swimmers, and that's when we started talking during a break in swimming.
That sounds great. And now you're back
now,
home
Kona's
working.
Kona's an interesting place. You know, one of the things John was telling us about is there's hot spots. And surprisingly, even though there's volcanoes there, there's no hot spots. Can you maybe elaborate a little on that, John?
Yeah, I think that the climate in the Kona region is much more similar to California than it is Hawaii. So as funny as that may sound, but the west side of the Big Island is the dry side of the island. It's sheltered from the prevailing winds. Therefore, it's sheltered from much of the cloudiness that covers the east side of the island. And as a result, the drier climate in Kona tends to be sunnier, drier, maybe a bit less windy. The ocean is calmer, and it's really more like the dry climate of California than it is the humidity that you might think of normally being associated with the Hawaiian Islands. So much so that there's been several fires, wildland fires, on the Kona side of the island in the last couple of months that required suppression from firefighting resources and threats to homes and communities.
Have you worked out there in Hawaii or just kind of aware of what's going on there?
I have actually not worked in Hawaii yet, although my parent agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, has several wildlife refuges on the Big Island, and we do watch the fire danger on the Big Island, and the opportunity for a working visit to the Big Island is not out of the question due to the surveillance that we must maintain for judging the fire danger in those wildlife refuges.
So you watch out for the fire danger all over the United States, or are you in charge of just one specific area?
A good question, Tippi. My area of responsibility is Oregon and Washington, and on a daily basis I'm looking at the fire danger in Oregon and Washington and the likelihood of getting large costly fires that are going to demand firefighting resources. But at the same time, I do maintain an eye on the fire danger in other areas of the United States for the reason that if the fire danger is low in Oregon and Washington at the moment, we may well wind up sharing our firefighting resources here with other geographic parts of the United States, including California, the desert Southwest, the Great Basin, the Northern Rocky Mountains, or Alaska. And my job involves the most efficient use of firefighting resources, which means that we share them across each other's borders at times. That goes so far as to looking at the fire danger in Canada primarily in British Columbia and Alberta, also the fire danger across the Pacific and our cousins down in Australia and New Zealand as well, whom we also share firefighting resources with depending upon what time of year it is. So to answer your question directly, I watch most closely here in Oregon and Washington, but I also watch elsewhere with an eye toward sharing of firefighting resources.
Wow. So if somebody wants to do what you're doing, which sounds fascinating and a lot of people would love to be able to do that, where would you tell them to start?
Well, I started as a kid who liked to look up at the sky, looking at clouds drifting across the sky and wondered why on some days those clouds got big and created rain and other days they didn't. But my path took me down the road of being interested in the earth sciences, geology, oceanography, meteorology, geography, those kinds of things. And, to summarize it, I started learning to fly when I was a young man. In fact, I had a pilot's license before I had a driver's license. And
wow.
My interest in weather was certainly spurred by aviation. And like every young man who saw the movie Top Gun in 1980, I wanted to be a fighter pilot, a Navy fighter pilot. And
right.
I was not able to go that route, but I went to my backup, which was the next closest thing closest to it, which was the study of the air, the atmosphere, and meteorology. And that is when I signed up for San Jose State University's meteorology and forecasting program back in 1981. And I completed my bachelor's degree there by 1986 and was prepared to go off as a forecaster and forecast weather. I was lucky enough to get hired by the National Weather Service in the mid-'80s. And unlike some of my friends who hot-footed it off to places like Texas or Oklahoma where there's tornadoes, or Florida where there's hurricanes, I was sent to a small office in Northern California that provided support to wildland firefighters, and it was there I began learning my trade, so much so that I knew from the first couple of days on the job what I wanted to do for the rest of my career, which was work with firefighters and giving them weather information for most safe and efficient wildland firefighting.
So what you're saying is if somebody really wants to do what you're doing, the first thing they have to do is look up at the sky for a while.
Yeah.
Make a decision of where they're going to go from there. So you found what you love to do actually by doing it, by joining it, by getting the education, and then eventually getting to a point of saying, oh, yeah, this is it. This is where I want to stay. It's not like you decided I'm going to be a meteorologist for the fire department ahead of time, but you kind of evolved into it naturally, which is really a nice way to do it.
I was lucky enough to be able to do that. At first, the assignment to a small forecasting office in Northern California seemed like a disappointment to me. But as soon as I began working there and observing what it was the meteorologists at that weather office did and how closely they worked with firefighters, it was just the opposite. I found this is an intensely interesting field for two reasons. The first reason was that I got to very directly apply what I had learned about weather forecasting to a problem at hand, which is how to best manage wildland fires. Secondly, I found that firefighters very closely base their management actions and firefighting actions based upon what the weather is going to do. Therefore, good weather forecasts clearly conveyed to them are an important component of their daily job, their safety and their efficiency in firefighting. And both of those were rewarding to me, the science and the communication and the comradeship of that relationship.
Yeah, actually, it sounds like they would not be able to do their job without your information, because that's one variable that is present with everything they do. They have to know what the weather is going to be.
That's exactly right. The variations in weather have a huge influence upon wildland fire behavior. And unfortunately, if we look at decades past in the history of wildland firefighting across the United States, primarily in the western states, but also to some extent in the east, that there were several notorious tragedies of fire crews that were burned over by a sudden flare-up in a wildland fire. There were several in Southern California, several in Northern California. There were some in the Rockies. There were some in the Pacific Northwest. And it turned out, upon investigation, that lack of awareness of the total environment picture cost those firefighters their lives. They were not aware that the wind was going to shift. They were not aware that the temperature was going to get hotter and drier. They were not aware that lightning was coming their way. And since then, there's been a greater emphasis upon safety, and a big part of safety is awareness of how the weather patterns will affect what a wildland fire is likely to do.
Exactly, exactly. That changes everything. And wow, you know, like I said, I know that we can talk about it for hours and still not get enough. And time flies and we've come to the end of our time here. But this has been fascinating. It is always really amazing to find out that there are things going on behind the scenes of what they show us, because if they would come to you and ask you beforehand to predict it, then it would be an entirely different story, an entirely different angle of looking at it. So are you still working there? Do you plan to stay there for a long time?
I do. This is a career job for me for two reasons. I enjoy the work. The application of meteorology to the problem of wildland firefighting is intensely interesting, and it remains so decades later. Secondly, I have been fortunate enough to work with some very good people in fire, and the comradeship, the friendships that I have made both personally and professionally over the years have been a big plus in my career, and I feel ever so fortunate that I have been fortunate to work with people who I admire and respect and who take close action based upon the information that I give them.
That's wonderful, John. I think everybody would love to have a job that they enjoy. Robert, do you have any last questions before we totally run out of time here?
Absolutely. One of the other things, John, how's that book coming along? That's a good place maybe for some guys, children, kids, young adults wanting to get into your field.
Yeah, I have gradually been working on a textbook for the class that I teach at Clackamas Community College. It's a very basic or layman's introduction to what weather is all about and some of the tricks that we use for forecasting the weather and understanding how the weather varies in accordance with the pattern or with the terrain at hand. That's a long-term project. That certainly is true, but it's something that I'd gradually like to work on.
Wonderful. So we can look forward to one day having a book that will tell us a lot more details than you're able to tell us right now. Thank you so much, John, for joining us. It's been really a pleasure talking and discovering it. And maybe we'll check in with you again soon and see how it's going. Or when is the fire season, actually?
Typically in Oregon, we start ramping up fire activity in mid to late June, and it really hits us in July and August as things get hot and drier and we start getting lightning.
Would it be possible to talk to you in that season while things are happening so that we can find out what's going on behind the scenes of what we see?
It certainly is. Late afternoons here on the West Coast are a good time to talk.
Awesome. That sounds wonderful. I'm really looking forward to talking to you again. And I'd like to really thank you for joining us today. It's been very interesting because, honestly, I didn't even know that the firemen get that information. And I know that the weather conditions are important just because I live in California for many years. And when you live in California, fire is daily. Every year we go through a fire season. But I didn't know that they had a lot of inside information that they actually have before the fire happens, which is really amazing. So thank you so much, John.
Happy to help. Thank you.
Wonderful. John Fultenberg joining us from Oregon with information about what goes on behind the scenes when the fire comes to the end of our time together here on Tippy Talk. It has been wonderful chatting with you, John Fultenberg, today. And thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Tippy Talk, where we bid you a magical journey and let your talent be your potion. My name is Tippy Felsenstein, and I have been talking today to John Fultenberg. And joining us also was Robert Goodhall. Thank you, Robert, for joining us also. Don't need a man, you got a phone in your hand, and you can keep it silent, flying high like a bird with your aviators, but your heart